Hello, and welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Alex Brightman and Jamie Dumont.
Hello.
Hi there.
Wow. That was formal as it gets, kids.
Hello.
Hello to you, sir, 2021. And we honestly, truth be told, we are so excited to have you both with us today for this monumentally crazy case.
Killers, we have two guests from California today. Jess and I have realized that there are just certain states that have produced more sociopaths, and not just on Broadway. So today we have got 2-time Tony nominee as well as a fellow podcaster. Hey, Fabulous Invalid. And while that is all very sexy, we are not here to talk about that today.
Damn. I mean, that's fine.
We love your lives and careers, but today it's not about that. But in general, we've realized that most of us theater profesionales seem to be freaks. So we welcome you to the fold. We assume that you're also in the freak section of life. And we literally spend hours wondering things like, am I a serial killer? Was I a serial killer in a past life? Maybe I'm the Night Stalker in New Jersey. So we want to know from the both of you, what made you interested in true crime? Why don't we start alphabetically? Alex, tell us why you're into true crime, why you think theater people are also into true crime.
Here's why I'm into true crime. I think it's because it's so real. And I think that it, like, all of a sudden, you know, when you're faced with any type of even minor crime, when it becomes, you know, it's so much easier to think about crime as a fantastical thing that, like, you know, we watch movies. We don't grow up watching documentaries. We grow up watching movies. So crime is fictional for most of our growing up. And that was, for me, it was like, you know, the car chases and explosions and cartoons and all that kind of. And so you don't really equate it with it being real. And so I think that true crime is fascinating because, yes, it's exciting. Yes, it's weird. Yes, it is so out there. But then at some point when you're watching it or reading about it, you have to remind yourself, this is real. This happened to a person. This is happening to a person. And so it becomes frightening, but also titillating. And also just there's something about it that's so far away from who you are, but also kind of close to who you are, too, that I find to be a little weird as an actor. And I think that's why actors kind of get into this thing, is because I think that we love to put on different skins and see what it feels like to be other people, some more than others. But I think that a lot of serial killers and a lot of people that would be classified as psychopaths or sociopaths have that in common with us. They like to put on different skins, pretend to be other people, pretend to be indestructible. And I think there is something about playing pretend that goes along hand in hand with being a serial killer.
Wow. That's fascinating and very frightening. my fascination with serial killers began with this case. I have a direct connection to one of the victims. And so that is something that, not only being in Los Angeles at the time of this happening and all the sort of news hubbub about it, knowing someone that was a victim in the case opened up my lifelong fascination. I then went into Zodiac. I went into Jack the Ripper and down the line. And I think it's interesting what Alex said. I do think there's an interesting correlation between serial killers and the masks that we all wear in our daily lives and in our professional lives. So that's how I got involved.
And I think it's just also like, except we decide to take the mask off after we do the little story about it, whereas somebody who is in our, you know, sociopathic, psychopathic sphere just decides, like, you know what? I'm going to put this mask on, kill a couple peeps, and that was cool until I have to put it on again. Like, somehow it's okay.
Even, I would say, though, even the most method actor knows that they're acting. So, like, you, as deep as you get into something, there is a part of you that is tethered to the outside world that you can pull back out of. And no matter how deep you've gotten, you are able to pull yourself out. It is that whatever is wires crossed or a made serial killer, which I think Richard Ramirez is, rather than being born bad, I think that whatever that is, it sort of cuts that tether. And so there is no, and not to sympathize, but a little bit, there's no way to pull yourself back out.
Mm-hmm. I also think everyone can relate to the stalker aspect of serial killers. Like, I feel I mean, even the best of us, we all like to do deep dives on new people. We all, especially with social media and the internet and all the different ways you can sort of search things and get obsessive about something. I think we all have that in us to some degree.
I just told Jessica the other day on our Killing It on Broadway Instagram account that during the O.J. Simpson trial, I was obsessed with court TV. So much so that this is in the time, too, where there was still a paper phone book. And I was like, Terry Moran, I think he lives in New York. So I looked up his name in the phone book and I called his machine.
Amazing.
That is stalking. Literally stalking.
Can I do you one better about the OJ case and court TV?
Please.
Where I got this love of stuff of crime from is from my mother, and she is obsessed, was completely obsessed with the OJ trial.
Same.
And watched court TV, I mean, around the clock. And I would come home from school and watch with her. My mom went to the neighborhood where the crimes were committed, mm-hmm. and like took pictures with a wind up camera, disposable camera, and like over the fence where Cato lived, and like, she has pictures like near the gate, and she's like thumbs up, and okay, so I understand the stalking bit quite a bit.
Are we still blessed with your mother's presence? Or is she still with us? Your mom?
Yeah, she is. She's fully with us on Earth. No, all right. No, so, OJ got to her.
Oh, God. No, but I'm just thinking this would be a great Patreon bonus episode. Alex and his mom, Jessica.
I'm telling you, you think you have my mom is the gold mine. I'm just a piece of gold that came out.
Well, if you're dear Alex's mom, if you are out there and still have that Kodak camera that you took to Walmart to get developed, we would like to see those photos of you having a grand old time in Brentwood.
I might be able to ask her after this.
I might be able to do one better.
Well,
I too actually did the tour of the crime scene and Bundy and OJ's house with a very good friend of mine on her honeymoon. I swear to God, this is what they wanted to do, was come to Los Angeles, stay with me and my husband and do this tour. This was, you know, 95, I think. So, you know, around that time period.
Yeah.
So we go to Bundy, we go see the condo, we drive over to Rockingham to drive by OJ's house. I kid you not, the gate is open and OJ is getting out of a car and going into, and she has VHS of that. She was filming she had a video recorder. She was filming the whole time. I will see if she still has it. I bet she does.
Oh my gosh. Jessica, we should just throw out today's script and do the OJ Simpson.
I was honestly just going to say, thank you all for joining us. That is the end of today's episode. Thank you for all of the OJ memorabilia. I too was obsessed, but I don't have stories like any of you three. Jen, will you take us away on our friend Richard Ramirez, if you would?
I will. Today, we are going to discuss one of the most infamous serial killers of all time. But first, credit where credit is due. We got some of our info from Wikipedia as well as insider.com. So here we go. This is The Night Stalker. Richard Ramirez was born in El Paso, Texas on February 29th, 1960, the youngest of Julian and Mercedes Ramirez's five children. His father, Julian, a Mexican national and former Juarez, Mexico policeman, who later became a laborer on the Santa Fe Railroad, was prone to fits of anger that often resulted in physical abuse. As a 12-year-old, Richard, or Richie, as he was known to his family, was strongly influenced by his older cousin Miguel, otherwise known as Mike Ramirez, a decorated U.S. Army Green Beret combat veteran. That's like you, Jamie, right? That's your U.S., right? Okay.
Absolutely.
Combat veteran who often boasted of his gruesome exploits during the Vietnam War. He shared Polaroid photos of his victims, including Vietnamese women whom he had raped. In some of the really nice. In some of the photos, this is really awful, Jessica. Hold your reaction. In some of the photos, Mike posed with the severed head of a woman he had abused. The severed head. I'd say abused is not really the right word. Ramirez, who had begun smoking marijuana at the age of 10, bonded with Mike over joints and gory war stories. Mike taught his younger cousins some of his military skills, such as killing with stealth. Around this time, Ramirez began to seek escape from his father's violent temper by sleeping in a local cemetery, which I just have to say, that seems perfectly reasonable to me. Alex, like I would sleep in a cemetery.
I actually feel like you would, Jen. I would. I know you would.
I actually would. I would do that.
It's really more about your beliefs. If you don't believe in zombies, then you're fine.
Oh, Okay, well, we pose that question to all of you listening, so have a think about it. and while you're thinking, I'm going to go ahead and tell you that Ramirez was present on May 4th of 1973 when his cousin Mike fatally shot his wife, Jessie. Did you give me this on purpose, Jen? Because my name is Jessica, but whatever, we'll talk about it later. In the face with a .38 caliber revolver during a domestic argument. And after the shooting, Ramirez became sullen and withdrawn from his family and peers. And later that year, he moved in with his older sister, Ruth, and her husband, Roberto, an obsessive, quote, peeping Tom, who took Richie along on his nocturnal exploits. Ramirez also began using LSD and cultivated an interest in Satanism. Mike was found not guilty of Jesse's murder by reason of insanity and was released in 1977 after 4 years of incarceration at the Texas State Mental Hospital. His influence over Ramirez continued. Now, the adolescent Ramirez began to meld his burgeoning sexual fantasies with violence, including forced bondage and rape. And while still in school, he took a job at a local Holiday Inn where he used his passkey. Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
He used his passkey to rob sleeping patrons. His employment ended very abruptly after a hotel guest returned to his room to find Ramirez attempting to rape his wife. Although the husband beat Ramirez senseless at the scene, which 300 points for Gryffindor, sir, criminal charges were dropped when the couple who lived out of state declined to return to testify against him. Really?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
By the way, can I say one thing? I love that this, the sort of the usage of words that they're using, sort of like the abused severed head. But also, I like that they call what he was doing exploits. That's,
I know.
like it just sounds like it was like, you know, and Hitler's festivities back in the 1940s. Like
let's
it's just
put
the
some
wrong,
cotton
it's the
candy.
Wrong, yeah, it's really painting a much more pastel picture of what was going on.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and here's a case that we recently discussed also. There were a couple of people who had been abused by the killer at the time, and they never showed up to court, and therefore it was thrown out completely. So these moments kind of make me shake my head a little bit that they never were able to return to testify against him. So Ramirez drops out of Jefferson High School in the ninth grade. And then at the age of 22, he moved to California, where he settled permanently. Now,
what did he do then?
Oh, aren't you? Well, funny you ask, Alex, because trigger warning, we're going to start sharing the details of the murders. Where on April 10th of 1984, Ramirez murdered 9-year-old Chinese American Mei Lung in the basement of the hotel where he was living in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco. Now, he raped and beat the girl before stabbing her to death and hanged her body from a pipe. This, Ramirez's first known killing, was not initially identified as being connected to the subsequent crime spree. But in 2009, and thank goodness for, you know, the DNA world and CODIS and all of these databases, his DNA was matched to a sample obtained at that crime scene. And in 2016, officials disclosed evidence of a second suspect identified through a DNA sample retrieved from that scene who is believed to have been present at Leung's murder. Authorities have not publicly identified the suspect, described as being a juvenile at the time, and they have not brought charges due to the lack of evidence. But I just had to say, like, praise DNA.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Absolutely.
Hashtag praise DNA.
Well, get that going, Alex, would you? Hashtag praise DNA.
Yeah, sure.
So on June 28th, 1984, 79-year-old Jenny Vincow was found brutally murdered in her apartment in Glassell Park, Los Angeles. She had been stabbed repeatedly while asleep in her bed and her throat slashed so deeply that she was nearly decapitated. Ramirez's fingerprint was found on a mesh screen he removed to gain access through an open window.
And on March 17th of 1985, Ramirez attacked 22-year-old Maria Hernandez outside her home in Rosemead, California, shooting her in the face with a .22 caliber handgun after she pulled into her garage. She survived. When the bullet ricocheted off the keys she held in her hands as she lifted them to protect herself, which, by the way, I know we often joke about holding our keys to protect ourselves, but hello?
It's the ultimate example of
the one example. Yeah. Now, inside the house was her roommate, Dale Yoshi Okazaki, 34 years old, who heard the gunshot and ducked behind a counter when she saw Maria Ramirez enter the kitchen. Now, when she raised her head, he shot her once in the forehead, killing her. And within an hour of the Rosemead home invasion, Ramirez pulled 30-year-old Cy Leon otherwise known as Veronica Yu, out of her car in Monterey Park, California, shot her twice with a .22 caliber handgun and then fled. She was pronounced dead upon arrival at the hospital. And those two murderers, an attempted third in a single day, attracted so much coverage from news media, who dubbed the curly-haired attacker with bulging eyes and wide-spaced rotting teeth the, quote, walk-in killer and, quote, the valley intruder. How is this real?
You guys are, yeah, I see you nodding, Alex. Did you know of those?
Well, the only reason I know this stuff is because I got recently obsessed with the original Night Stalker, which was the Golden State Killer, right? And so one of the things, the reasons why it was hard to, the reason why people give serial killers names like this, why the police will even go as far as to do it, is because it gets people's attention to be on alert. If you just call somebody, oh, it's the, we're looking for an unknown suspect, people just turn away. So to give it some, like, weirdly, it's like marketing. It's like a weird press thing that makes people more aware. If you give them kind of a sexy name to put on something, it gets people involved.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's fascinating.
Patton Oswalt was saying, like, you know, giving props to his deceased wife, Michelle McNamara, for coming up with the Golden State Killer. Because before it was like, it was
Eons.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you. You know, and so
now if the two of you, Alex and Jamie, it doesn't have to be murder related, were to give yourself a tagline that you believe is sexy, what would it be? It's your very, like, your Real Housewife tagline, except it's, you know, not.
Is this you said tagline, or is this like what my moniker?
This is your moniker. Sorry.
Is this our serial killer moniker?
Yeah, yes, it's a serial killer moniker. But we preface it with, well, you are not serial killers. But if you had one, what would it be?
He kills with kindness.
Oh my!
It's so funny you just said that. I was thinking the compliment killer.
Oh.
Well, we should go on a crime spree.
Let's go. Yeah, Bonnie and Clyde. Let's do it.
Take that clown behind you. Jamie has a clown behind him, by the way. It's Bozo.
It's not just a clown. It's Bozo.
It's Bozo.
I should also say it's a punching bag clown, right? It's one of those things where you hit and it never falls over.
That's right. She's bottom heavy. Yeah.
It bobbles. It's a clown bobble.
I have to compliment the both of you. Those were excellent names with no notice. Really well done.
I know.
Really well done.
Thank you.
Might have thought about mine in a prior engagement, maybe just in my room alone, thinking about my serial killer name. I do want to say, though, getting back to Richard Ramirez, as someone who was in Los Angeles in 1984 and around the time that, you know, he got the name and all of this was happening, it is not, I think, hyperbolic to say that the city was gripped with fear. And it was really like all, not unlike the O.J. Simpson trial a decade later, it was all anyone could talk about. And it's, and you know, it was the first time I ever remember my family locking their door. And that was the first time I ever carried a key, was because we started locking our doors. I never carried a key until I was, you know, 17 years old. And it's kind of staggering to me also that where I lived in Los Angeles, which was Pasadena, just a few years earlier, maybe not quite a decade earlier, there was the Hillside Strangler. So in my particular community, which is where a lot of these Glendora, Glassell Park, Monrovia, Monterey Park, where many of these killings were happening of Richard Ramirez's, we were thinking, like, what is it in the water where we live in particular that these crimes continue to happen with great regularity?
Well, yeah. I'll tell you, it's the Pasadena Excellent. Playhouse. That's what it is.
Oh, no.
You know, I worked there. You know, it's haunted. Anyway, go ahead, Jen, please.
Is it Danny Feldman's fault?
It is.
Yeah. Damn him.
First of all, Jessica, thank you for that joke, because we all laughed and it's going to go right into the commercial break. So well done.
Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-STEP, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song,
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
So, getting us back. On March 27th, 1985, Ramirez entered a home that he had burglarized a year earlier in Whittier, California at approximately 2 a.m. and killed the sleeping Vincent Charles Zazera, age 64, with a gunshot to his head from a .22 caliber handgun. Zazera's wife, Maxine Lavinia Zazera, aged 44, was awakened by the gunshot, and Ramirez beat her and bound her hands while demanding to know where her valuables were. While he ransacked the room, Maxine escaped her bonds and retrieved a shotgun from under the bed, which was not loaded. This infuriated Ramirez, who then shot her three times with the .22, then fetched a large carving knife from the kitchen. He mutilated her body by stabbing her several times, then gouged out her eyes. Then gouged out her eyes and placed them in a jewelry box, which he left with. The autopsy determined that the mutilations were post-mortem. Ramirez left footprints from a pair of Avia sneakers in the flower beds, which the police photographed and cast. This was virtually the only evidence that the police had at that time. Bullets found at the scene were matched to those found at previous attacks, and the police realized a serial killer was at large. Vincent and Maxine's bodies were discovered by their son, Peter.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Also, I learned a new term by reading about this person, was that a person that takes someone's eyes out, as the actual, does he know what that is?
No.
It's an interesting vocab word for everybody listening. He committed enucleation. Wow. Is what it's called.
It starts
with an E, enucleation.
Thank you, Dr. Brightman. We must inform the both of you now that on our podcast, we are all experts. And Dr. Brightman, thank you for that. And thank you, Dr. Dumont, for your input. I cannot wait to get to the part that I know you speak of, because the Avia footprints come into play in that as well. So thank you. Thank you, doctor, for teaching us that new word.
You're welcome. That sounded slightly condescending, but I'll stick around.
I must say that without any condescension, I consider myself also an expert anytime I discuss anything. So now you are the enuncula. Is it enunculation? Enunculation.
It is not. Enucleation.
Enucleation. Okay. Well, I will not go to sleep tonight. As we really do consider ourselves doctors, though, by the way, on this podcast, even though we are absolutely fucking not. On May 14th, 1985, Ramirez returned to Monterey Park and entered the home of Bill Doy, who's 66, and his disabled wife, Lillian, who's 56. Surprising Doy in his bedroom, Ramirez shot him in the face with, yet again, a .22 semi-automatic pistol as Doy went for his own handgun. And after beating the mortally wounded man into unconsciousness, Ramirez entered Lillian's bedroom, bound her with thumb cuffs, then raped her after he ransacked the home again for valuables. Bill Doy subsequently died of his injuries while in the hospital.
And to Jamie's point earlier, Richard Ramirez would, I think, be considered a rapid sequence offender, because this is all happening in about a year, like 84 to 85. It was just one after another.
These are the things I don't know, like Alex was talking about before, when you watch this shit in movies and you think that this is not real, that this can't possibly happen in real life. Yeah. And it did. In a year.
What I want to know is, and I don't know if we know the answer to this, thumb cuffs. Did he have the thumb cuffs on him? Were they in the home and he used what he could find? It's such a random, weird fact.
Mm-hmm. It is weird.
I don't know the answer. And when we don't know the answer, we like to put it to our listeners, because there are so many books on the subject. And of course, we went to a few sources. There are innumerable sources out there. So if anyone has the answer to Jamie's question, you will be given the title of doctor as well. And we would love to know.
And I don't know if you said this, Jessica, you may have, but she was in a wheelchair, correct?
Yes, that particular, she was.
Right?
She was.
So it's just such a strange piece of the puzzle. Every time I hear that, that always just sticks out as one more like odd thing about this guy and his patterns.
It does make you wonder, did he acquire a kit?
Yeah.
Or was this something that his cousin had, you know, or God forbid, something his father used on him? It's a great question. I don't know.
Childhood, you know.
Do they make military grade thumb cuffs?
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I can figure out, I guess, what they'd be, but I'm not 100% sure what they're used for.
I was going to say, I didn't even know there was such a thing.
Right.
I know there was.
Or are they, are your thumbs cuffed together? Are they cuffed to, were the thumbs cuffed to the arms of the wheelchair?
Ah, good point.
This is where my brain goes. I'm sorry. I took us down a thumb cuff path, but it just always fascinates me.
It's okay, kindness killer. It is okay.
I have the answer to thumb cuffs, you guys. I don't know if you can see it, but basically they're small and kept in the pocket. And it's a way to sort of keep your opposable thumbs out of the picture, because even if your wrists are cuffed, you could still pick up things. And it
now, Jamie, right? To your point, you might not receive a diploma of your doctoral degree from us, but I will be sending thumb cuffs.
So. Oh, well, who doesn't like a thumb cuff?
So enjoy it.
Okay. All right. On the night of May 29th, 1985, Ramirez drove a stolen car to Monrovia, California, and stopped at the house of Mabel Mabel. She was 83 years old, and her disabled sister, Florence Nettie Lang, 81. Finding a hammer in the kitchen, he bludgeoned and bound Lang in her bedroom, then bound and bludgeoned Bell before using an electrical cord to shock the woman. After raping Lang, he used Bell's lipstick to draw a pentagram on her thigh, as well as on the walls of both bedrooms. The women were found 2 days later, alive but comatose. Bell later died of her injuries, and on the next day, Ramirez drove the same car to Burbank, California, and sneaked into the home of Carol Kyle, aged 42. At gunpoint, he bound Kyle and her 11-year-old son with handcuffs, then ransacked the house. I know, children always, I know. He released Kyle to direct him to where the family's valuables were. He then raped her repeatedly. Ramirez also repeatedly ordered her not to look at him, telling her at one point that he would, quote, cut her eyes out, end quote. What's the term, Alex?
I'm going to let Jess take it. What is it, Jess?
It is enunciation.
That's exactly wrong. It is enucleation.
Damn it!
Enucleation. So he fled the scene after retrieving the child from the closet and binding the two together again with the handcuffs.
Now, on the night of July 2nd, 1985, he drove a stolen car to Arcadia, California, randomly selected the house of Mary Louise Cannon, 75 years old. And after quietly entering the widowed grandmother's home, he found her asleep in her bedroom, where he bludgeoned her into unconsciousness with a lamp and then repeatedly stabbed her using a 10-inch butcher knife from her kitchen. She was found dead at the scene.
And we're about to go to the area that you know about, Jamie, as on July 5th, 1985, Ramirez broke into a home in Sierra Madre, California, and bludgeoned 16-year-old Whitney Bennett with a tire iron as she slept in her bedroom. After searching in vain for a knife in the kitchen, Ramirez attempted to strangle the girl with a telephone cord. He was startled to see electrical sparks emanate from the cord, and when his victim began to breathe, he fled the house with her jewelry, leaving behind a bloody footprint. Bennett survived the savage beating, although 478 stitches were required to close the lacerations to her scalp. Now, Wikipedia states he fled believing that Jesus Christ had intervened and saved him, but I wonder if she's the one that believed that, not him, because it struck me as odd that he thought that Jesus Christ had saved her. I don't know. I'm just going to go. But did any of that sound inaccurate to you? And do you have anything to add?
I can see where that sounds weird, but
it does sound weird, particularly because he was a Satanist, as far as we know. So as the audience all knows, I have a connection to this case. Whitney Bennett was a good friend of mine in high school. I knew her quite well. And, you know, my understanding and my memory of the incident, her attack, is she does not remember any of it. She woke up the next morning with a headache. And I can't remember if she managed to wake her family up or if they came in to check on her. I don't quite remember. And that's when they found her. Her brother was in the next room the entire time. And, you know, you have to understand these California houses, that house was probably built in, you know, the late 60s, maybe the early 70s with those paper thin walls. So it's so hard to imagine that her entire family was home, her brother in the next room, and they didn't hear him beating her with a tire iron. I believe she passed out immediately, so she wouldn't have made any noise. So I don't think, Jen, to answer your question, that she remembered waking up and startling him. But I do know that she found, she became a born-again Christian as an adult. So it is possible that these facts are conflated and that it was actually her Whitney that thought she was saved by God, but I don't actually know.
I mean, and I guess in a situation like that, sorry to interrupt, in a situation like that, if you get through some shit like that and you survive on the other side, I would understand why you'd be like, I'm into Jesus. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think mm-hmm. I mean, this is a, you know, I think a lot of survivors tell stories of, you know, finding a coping mechanism, whether it's God, whether it's drugs and alcohol. Like, it's not an easy thing. I'm sure you guys talk about this a lot on your show. It's not an easy thing. I know when I saw Whitney after the attack and, you know, she had had some of the surgery, reconstructive surgery to her face. She had a big scar in the shape of a V on her forehead. She was not in great shape. You know what I mean? She was not able to really hold a conversation without crying and hugging. And it was very emotional for everyone. So I don't know how you deal with that without finding some coping mechanism, whether positive or negative.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say something. Well, yeah. Something else that's interesting is that, you know, she ended up marrying the man she's still married to and has children with, the son of one of the investigators on the case.
Oh, so, no shit.
Yeah. So it's interesting how, you know, these things get so layered at certain times in these cases.
We talk about that sometimes, something positive coming out of something so horrific. And that's definitely a positive thing.
I just also want to say that that's what I would actually like to see a Hallmark movie about. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I don't mean to be a Pollyanna. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I will say she does live a very productive life for all intents and purposes, has really survived this and is thriving as an adult.
To me, that is unbelievable in ways where, like, you find the good, and then at the other end, and part of me, a very small part of me, then goes, like, what do you say when somebody goes, how did you two meet? You know? It's like, because that's like, you must either, one, have to just be, have told it so many times that you just go, look, this happened, and I'm sure you heard about it, and this is how we met. Or you have to just go, like, it was a blind date. You know, you just make it up, because it would inevitably, somebody somewhere is going to say, how'd you meet? And, you know, that always just comes up. How did you two meet?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually.
And the answer is, this happened to me, and I wouldn't have met this person if, which is also its odd own version of, can we swear on this?
Yes.
Yes.
It's its own. It's a massively fucked up, complicated thing, because it's as happy as she is and all that kind of stuff. And I'm thrilled, because I don't, you know, putting yourself in that position is like, I don't even know. I don't think you'd ever hear from me again it's inescapable. But it's weird, because it's like her life is now wonderful and married to somebody wonderful. And if those turns of events didn't happen, she wouldn't have met this specific person, which I find to be so wildly complicated as a thought.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I do believe everything happens for a reason, good, bad, ugly. But this is, you know, this is the kind of shit this is nightmare shit. And I sort of, the amount of work that it takes somebody to get through that, therapeutically at least, to go from that experience to, you know, where she is now, which is this outstanding life and a beautiful life. But, you know, those memories, I'm sure, don't escape you, no matter where you are, how much time has passed. So I think it's a testament to how strong she is, really.
It's unbelievable. That's ridiculous. I mean, it's like, I think it's a strength that I think very few people might have.
Agree. Let me move us on, because we've got quite a ways to go. So on July 7th, 1985, Ramirez burglarized the home of Joyce Lucille Nelson, 61 years of age, in Monterey Park. Finding her asleep on her living room couch, he beat her to death using his fists and kicking her in the head. Yet again, a shoe print from an Avia sneaker was left imprinted on her face. After cruising two other neighborhoods, he returned to Monterey Park and chose the home of Sophie Dickman, 63. Ramirez assaulted and handcuffed Dickman at gunpoint, attempted to rape her, and stole her jewelry. When she swore to him that he had taken everything of value, he told her to, quote, swear on Satan. Cool.
That's nice. On July 20th, 1985, Ramirez purchased a machete. Before driving a stolen Toyota to Glendale, California, he chose the home of Lila Needing, age 66, and her husband, Maxon, age 68. He burst into the sleeping couple's bedroom and hacked them with the machete, good Lord, then killed them with shots to the head from a .22 caliber handgun. He further mutilated their bodies with the machete before robbing the house of valuables. After quickly fencing the stolen items from the Needing residence, Ramirez drove to Sun Valley. At approximately 4:15 a.m., he broke into the home of the
Covenant family. He shot the sleeping Chainarong Covenant in the head with a 25 caliber handgun, killing him instantly, then repeatedly raped and beat Somkid Covenant. He bound the couple's terrified 8-year-old son before dragging Somkid around the house to reveal the location of any valuable items which he stole. During his assault, he demanded that she too swear to Satan that she was not hiding any money from him.
And just when you think it might be over, it's not, because on August 6th, 1985, Ramirez drove to Northridge, California, and broke into the home of Chris and Virginia Peterson, crept in the bedroom, startled Virginia, 27 years old, shot her in the face with a 25 caliber handgun, then shot Chris in the neck and attempted to flee. Chris fought back while avoiding being hit by two more shots during the struggle before Ramirez managed to escape. And this couple survived their injuries.
And on August 8th, Jessica... my birthday, yet again.
A lot of
crimes happened on my birthday. On August 8th, 1985, Ramirez drove a stolen car to Diamond Bar, California,
and chose the home of Sakina Abuith, age 27, and her husband, Elias Abuith, age 31. Sometime after 2:30 a.m., he entered the house and went into the master bedroom. He instantly killed the sleeping Elias with a shot to the head from a 25 caliber handgun. He handcuffed and beat Sakina while forcing her to reveal the locations of the family's jewelry and then brutally raped her. He repeatedly demanded that she swear on Satan that she would not scream during his assaults. When the couple's 3-year-old son entered the bedroom, Ramirez tied the child up and then continued to rape her. After Ramirez left the home, Sakina untied her son and sent him to the neighbors for help. Ramirez, who had been following the media coverage of his crimes, left Los Angeles and headed to the San Francisco Bay Area.
You're welcome, Alex. Now he's in your hood.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I wasn't, you were born
I wasn't,
that.
I wasn't born yet.
You weren't born yet. But no. But in 85, was it 85?
85, yeah.
85.
No, I was okay. I was born in 87. This was in 84.
Oh, excuse me. This was in 85. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I was born I was born 87 as well.
Yeah. I was born in 97. On August 18th, 1985, he entered the home of Peter and Barbara Pan. He shot the sleeping Peter, age 66, in the temple with a 25 caliber handgun. He then beat and sexually assaulted Barbara, age 62, before shooting her in the head and leaving her for dead. At the crime scene, Ramirez used lipstick to scrawl a pentagram and the phrase "Jack the Knife" on the bedroom wall, which is random. When it was discovered that the ballistics and shoe print evidence from the Los Angeles crime scenes matched the Pan crime scene, San Francisco's then mayor, Dianne Feinstein, divulged the information in a televised press conference. This leak infuriated the detectives in the case, as they knew the killer would be following media coverage, which gave him the opportunity to destroy crucial forensic evidence. Ramirez, who had indeed been watching the press, dropped his size 11 and a half Avia sneakers over the side of the Golden Gate Bridge that night. He remained in the area for a few more days before heading back to the Los Angeles area.
I'm mad at her. I'm a little bit pissed.
I'm mad.
I guess that's why investigators get so pissed off when somebody's like, I want to be able I want this information.
Yeah.
And just, guys, just so you know, we're rounding third. We're almost there.
I'm looking up Jack the Knife.
Well, while you look that up, I want to keep going and say that on August 24th of 1985, Ramirez then traveled 76 miles south of Los Angeles in a stolen orange Toyota to Mission Viejo. And later that night, he arrived at the home of James Romero Jr., who had just returned from a family vacay to Rosarito Beach in Mexico. Romero's son, who's 13-year-old James Romero III, happened to be awake and heard Ramirez's footsteps outside the house, thinking there was a prowler. Little James goes to wake his parents, and Ramirez fled the scene. James raced outside, noted the color, make, and style of the car, as well as a partial license plate number. Go, James.
Go, James.
He contacted the police with this information, believing James had chased away a thief. And after this encounter, Ramirez broke into the house of Bill Carnes, 30, and his fiancée, Inez Erickson, 29, through a back door. He entered the sleeping couple's bedroom and awakened Carnes when he cocked his 25 caliber handgun, shot Carnes 3 times in the head before turning his attention to Erickson. Now, Ramirez told the terrified woman that he was the, quote, night stalker, and forced her to swear she loved Satan as he beat her with his fists and bound her with neckties from the closet. Now, after stealing what he could find, Ramirez dragged Erickson to another room to rape her. He then demanded cash, more jewelry, and made her, you guessed it, swear on Satan. And there was no more. Before leaving the home, Ramirez told Erickson, quote, tell them the night stalker was here. Erickson untied herself and went to a neighbor's house to get help for her severely injured fiancé. Surgeons removed 2 of the bullets from his head, and he was able to survive his injuries. Erickson gave a detailed description of the assailant to investigators, and police obtained a cast of Ramirez's footprint from the Romero house. The stolen car was found on August 28th in Wilshire Center, Los Angeles, and police obtained a single fingerprint from the rearview mirror despite Ramirez's careful efforts to wipe the car clean of his prints. Take that, Criminal Minds. The print was positively identified as belonging to Ramirez, who was described as a 25-year-old drifter from Texas with a long rap sheet that included many arrests for traffic and illegal drug violations. Law enforcement individuals decided to release to the media a mugshot of Ramirez from a December 12, 1984 arrest for auto theft, and the Night Stalker finally had a face. At a police press conference, it was announced, quote, "We know who you are now, and soon everyone else will. There will be no place you can hide." Ramirez was 24 years old when he began his serial murders. The mugshot of Ramirez, taken on December 12, 1984, directly led to his apprehension. I mean, finally, good God.
Right. And I'm sure we're going to get there, but I'm sure you all remember this on television, because I sure do. And Jamie, I definitely want to know from you who was there at the time. But on August 30th, 1985, Ramirez took a bus to Tucson, Arizona to visit his brother, unaware that he'd become the lead story in virtually every major newspaper and television news program across California. After failing to meet his brother, he returned to Los Angeles early on the morning of August 31st. He walked past police officers who were staking out the bus terminal in hopes of catching the killer should he attempt to flee on an outbound bus and into a convenience store in East Los Angeles. After noticing a group of elderly Mexican women fearfully identifying him as El Matador, which means the killer, Ramirez saw his face on the front pages on the newspaper rack and fled the store in a panic. After running across the Santa Ana freeway, he attempted to carjack a woman but was chased away by bystanders who pursued him. After hopping over several fences and attempting two more carjackings, he was eventually subdued by a group of residents, one of whom had struck him over the head with a metal bar in the pursuit. The group held Ramirez down and relentlessly beat him until the police arrived and took him into custody. And I love every single one of those people. Can you tell me about that, Jamie? Because I remember seeing the news reports and just going, yes, citizens, they just were not having it.
Yeah, I remember watching that on the news, my memory of it is that there was footage of it, or there were photographs that were taken that were released later of the crowd that was around Richard Ramirez. That might just be me creating false memories, but I have a very clear memory of it.
I do too.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, this is the thing about, it's like what I was saying earlier about how the city was just gripped with fear. There wasn't a single person in Los Angeles, well, probably the country, but particularly in Los Angeles, who didn't know what he looked like at this point, right? As soon as they released that photograph, it was everywhere. It was on every newsstand. And, you know, obviously this is in the days before the internet, so it was a different kind of thing, but it was extraordinary. It was really like the whole city just had a big sigh of relief.
Alex, I'd also like you, did you do your research and find Jack the, what were you doing?
I didn't. Google really, really, really thinks I'm trying to search Mac the Knife. And so it's really pointing me that way. So I haven't found anything of substance other than what you said. Other than that, it was just written on the wall.
I mean, that's some helter skelter shit too. You know what I mean?
Sure. And it obviously leaves an imprint because we're talking about it now.
No, that's very true.
What I thought was funny was about him getting on a bus and not realizing he was the top story of the world at that point. It's so unbelievable now because of how instant things are. And that, like, if something happens, we know about it within seconds, not minutes. And to be able to get on a bus with other people that don't have cell phones with internet on it, of course he wouldn't know. You'd have to stop at a newsstand. You'd have to be in front of a television. And so it's weird to think that you could feel free enough to get on a bus if you are this person, not having been realized that you've been drawn and exposed.
Remember the days where you could get on a bus with no ID, no driver's license? Like, that's how people would escape too. They would just get on a bus. And after 9/11, that all changed, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
what were you
going
to say, Jamie?
Well, I was going to say the thing I think I love the most about the capture of Richard Ramirez is that it was a close, tight-knit community that saw him and wouldn't let up and then kicked the shit out of him, right? Like that, they, you know, they beat him. He was not in great shape by the time the authorities got there. And I love that, right? Like, leave it to a small community to come in and just like take over and be in control. I love that's the end to this nightmare, at least in terms of his capture. Certainly isn't the end of the nightmare.
No.
Wow. Yeah. That's the kind of community I'd like to be in. You know what I mean? And I feel like I live in one of those communities. I'm in West New York, comma, New Jersey. And I feel like my community is still like, you know, you walk past everybody who you know on the street, like you go to the Zug Park and you know every owner just by the name of their Zug. But if something happened to somebody, you bet your left tata that everybody's going to come out and save the day together. Yeah. Like I love a close-knit small community of peeps.
And imagine being one of those people in the failed carjacks that he didn't get their car. Like imagine being that person, like, oh my God, I was almost the last victim of the Night Stalker.
So to be like that close to the spray of things is so weird.
Which would also fuck me up severely. That would fuck me up mentally. Alex, would you agree with this? Yeah. I mean, somebody side with me. Yeah.
I've been one time near a mugging, and the mugger ran past me after successfully getting the person's bag and knocked into my shoulder, and I couldn't speak for the rest of the day. I have a stutter that comes back here and there in high stress situations, mm-hmm. and it literally knocked the speech out of me for 24 hours because of how close you were to a thing. And this was not violent. It was just sort of a grab and go kind of thing, but I was like literally touched the person that did the thing. And it just was weird and too, exactly what Jamie was saying. It was just too close to, I wasn't involved, but all of a sudden I was involved. You know, you're like, you're kind of involved, but you're not.
That gives me chills.
I completely feel that it's a very strange thing to be, you know, party to at least. And by the way, you talked about your close-knit community, like, you know, saving the day and all that kind of stuff. And I couldn't feel more opposite about that, about New York City. I feel as if I was in the middle of the street and someone was lighting me on fire, people would warm their hands.
Yeah, I'm going to tend to say that's probably true. So, thank you for sharing. And I'd like to discuss jury selection of Richard's trial, which subsequently began on July 22nd of 1988. At this point, Alex had been born. And at Richard's first court appearance, Ramirez raised a hand with a pentagram drawn on it and yelled, "Hail Satan." On August 3rd of 1988, the Los Angeles Times reported that some jail employees overheard Ramirez planning to shoot the prosecutor with a gun, which Ramirez intended to have smuggled into the courtroom. And consequently, a metal detector was installed outside and intensive searches were conducted on people entering. On August 14th, this trial was interrupted because one of the jurors, Phyllis Singletary, did not arrive at the courtroom. Later that day, she was found shot to death in her apartment.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. Mm-hmm. The jury, as are we, were terrified. They couldn't help but wondering whether Ramirez had somehow directed the event from inside his prison cell and whether he could reach other jurors. However, it was ultimately determined that Ramirez was not responsible for Singletary's death as she was shot and killed by her boyfriend, who later committed suicide with the same weapon in a hotel. And the alternate juror who replaced Singletary was too frightened to return to her home. On September 20th of 1989, Ramirez was convicted of all charges, which were this: 13 counts of murder, 5 attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults, and 14 burglaries. During the penalty phase of the trial on November 7th of 1989, he was sentenced to die in California's gas chamber. And, Jamie, according to Insider.com, it is stated that his getting the death penalty was due in part to Whitney's emotional testimony. We are obviously going to check in with you. I saw you nodding. Is that something that you remember being the case?
I don't remember her testifying. And in fact, it's interesting. I told this to Jen before we started to do this, that my memory of it is that Whitney's name was changed because she had been a minor when the attacks happened. I think she was only 16. She was a year younger than I am. And so my memory of it was that she used her mother's newly married name and her middle name or something. I can't quite remember. And all the court transcripts were sealed, again, because she was a minor. But I don't know if she was a minor at the time that she testified. You know, time and memory have a way of playing tricks on you. So I don't actually know the answer to that. And I was fascinated when I did a little bit of research at how much there is on that. There's a big LA Times story on her testimony, and you know, she was weeping, but I didn't actually have any knowledge of that at the time, quite honestly, because that was all kept very, very private.
Sure. Well, I mean, listen, again, we talk about the strength of this particular woman, as are many of the victims who we have discussed who survived these attacks, to be able to get on the stand and testify while the attacker is in the room, no less, and to be able to do it with such, I'm sure, grace under pressure, and you know, being able to be that present is an incredible feat. I just have to say that, because this guy is such a sociopath, psychopath, complete serial killer, just in every single way that he did this in such a short amount of time to so many people is beyond me. And after he got the death penalty, after he got these death sentences, his actual quote was, "Big deal, big deal. Death always went with the territory. See you in Disneyland."
Yeah. That's the thing I remember being fascinated with, because I went through this phase a little while ago where I was fascinated with two things. One, last words, and also last meals. And so I became fascinated with that. And my wife and I are completely fascinated with that. Her dad is a public defender. And so we just deep dive into crime stuff. And so I remember hearing that a while ago, that his words when he was sentenced was that. But of course it was. I mean, it was over the course of many years, his soul got twisted and brain, you know, everything got rewired. And that kind of darkness is a weed, you know? And hearing the thing about the juror being murdered, it goes to show there's a lot of cases where it's not just the thing that's happening is dark, but things around it get dark. Like this, it becomes a shadow. Like, it's really strange when you hear things like that, because it's common that during a court case like this, other dark shit happens. And it's very strange, because then you start to, like, I'm not really a religious person. I don't really believe in a ton of things. I'm more of a spiritual leaning atheist, biting from somebody else. But when you see things like that, you're like, there's some, you know, cosmic shit going on.
Oh, yeah.
When that kind of stuff happens.
Yeah. I mean, again, case in point, not to bookend it, but good on me. The OJ case. I mean, again, it's like, look at that jury process. Yes, I mean, I mean, there are so many different juries that we could look at as far as all of these huge cases are concerned. But it's true. Like, when some bad shit happens, there's an umbrella over it that kind of casts shadows on the rest of it. So while it is terrifying that this happened to this juror, that makes sense to me that other jurors then coming in would be like, I'm not going home for the rest of this trial.
Yeah, that's very strange.
But see you in Disneyland. I mean, that is special. And and even though those were his last words, the judge who upheld the 19 death sentences remarked that his deeds exhibited, quote, cruelty, callousness, and viciousness beyond any human understanding. And the trial cost $1.8 million, which at the time made it the most expensive in the history of California until, ding, ding, it was surpassed by none other than the O.J. Simpson murder case in 1994.
Woof. I'm sure that one smashed it to pieces.
Oh, schmabillions.
Sure.
Yeah.
I also wanted to comment, Jessica, that 19 death sentences, like, we're really going to kill you. It's not one, you know, that's a lot of death sentences.
And yet they didn't.
They never got to.
Sorry. We are not at all. No, we're there. We're going to wrap this up. And I'm very excited about this, because Dr. Brightman, at the very start of this, you said that you believed he was a made serial killer. And interesting, this is very interesting. Your fellow doctor, psychiatrist Michael H. Stone, described Ramirez as, quote, a made psychopath, as opposed to a, quote, born psychopath. He said that Ramirez's schizoid personality disorder contributed to his indifference to the suffering of his victims and his untreatability. Ramirez died, as Dr. Dumont just told us, died of complications secondary to B-cell lymphoma at Marin General Hospital in Green Bay, California, on June 7th, 2013. He had also been affected by chronic substance abuse and chronic hepatitis C viral infection. Having been on death row for more than 23 years, he died at 53 years old. And that is the creepier than creepy story of the Night Stalker. You guys, thank
Can
you.
Can I say, well, the reason about the maid serial killer thing, which is why I was so excited to talk about this, is, and this is, I'm only slightly turning this to me for 1 second for
do
context.
It. No, do it.
But the, I'm one of the very first things I ever wrote with my writing partner is a musical that is a dark telling of a maid serial killer. And basically the idea is that this serial killer is a product of a million other people's mistakes. So it didn't have to go this way, is the idea, is that you look at the things you did in the beginning of this and you, all the things you said, that a person was born knowing nothing. And within 10 years, all of a sudden, all the things that Richard Ramirez knew was death, stealth, killing, hunting, indifference to death, and that it was fun and that it was part of life. That like people hunted people and that he didn't there was no one to tell him that was wrong, including the people that beat him. So he was just following this line.
Now answer me this. Do you believe that there was any predisposition in tandem with being taught all of these things, any predisposition mentally where that took play in this as well?
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there is that thing where they do talk about people are born wired wrong.
Correct.
You know, they sort of and whether it's substance abuse of the mom during pregnancy, things like that. For sure. I don't think it was sort of an unencumbered brain.
I mean, I just wonder, like, I'm sure both of these things were at play because I tend to agree with you that this was a maid situation. And it also makes me think, of everything that we've gone through in this past year of this pandemic, you start to think about the things that children are taught when they're not, you know, right. When you are, you know, born and you're a blank slate. And then all of a sudden, all of these other outside factors come in and become sticky and shape your life. So
go ahead, Jamie.
Well, I have to say that it has to be, to a certain extent, a lot of conditioning, because I feel like lots of children grow up being abused by one or both parents. Lots of children see death. Lots of children witness murders or horrific, horrific things, and they don't end up killing 19 people and becoming serial rapists and so on and so forth. So I do think while there is a genetic factor that could be part of it, I think a lot of it is environment and conditioning. I just don't see any other explanation.
And I do want to say for our listeners that while Dr. Dumont was saying that, Dr. Brightman was pointing like you have a car and you get a car and you also get a car. And so I think we are all in agreement here. I mean, yes. that's the scary part about these killers is you sort of look back and go, holy shit, you know?
Yeah. No, it's a broken record around here. Jess and I, we talk about it in almost every episode that it's no one size fits all. It's a combination of biological, psychological, environmental, and developmental reasons. And that is the one thing that all the people who have researched this long before we doctors have can agree on. I do have one final question to your comment about your script, Alex. And that is, are there any roles for two quirky sidekick actresses?
Yeah, sure. There could be.
Great. Okay, great.
I think, we're in the really deep in rewrites, and I think we're really going that direction. We're going a little more zany,
if it was like, I don't know if you ever wanted me to self-tape, because we're in quarantine as well. I'm like, don't shower often enough for me to be put into a position where like, oh, I'm the one who sits at home and could have a couple of cats and solve a crime.
That's good, though. No, I think the not showering thing actually is a plus for kind of some of the characters we're dealing with in our show. Mm-hmm. It's a little seedier. And so I think that you're already sort of there.
I knew.
I just think we would need, I think like maybe one director session.
Oh, I knew it. I just felt it.
Yeah.
And that Jessica, you know, thank you so much.
There you go.
I feel thrilled.
I was hoping, I'm glad I could be your agent and get you this job.
10%.
You guys.
That's right, baby.
You guys. Thank you. You know, we did the Zodiac with James Monroe Iglehart, who is from California, and we just had a good long talk. We said, we actually have a couple of other ladies from your home state. We're like, there's too many cases. It's a big state, and we can't thank you enough. We really were excited to have you both here today, and you added so much to it as locals, and we really appreciate you.
Thank you so much, really, for
of
doing
course.
This.
This was great.
Thank you.
I had a blast, and I will see you all later.
Okay,
nice
see you.
Nice to see you, Jamie. Nice to see you guys.
Bye, guys.
Mike, love you. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. What great guys. Love them both.
I mean, genius gents. Also funny. also they have, you know, the 411, like they get it. So while we're at it, because all of you get it too, killers, we love you. Absolutely. We do not love Richard Ramirez, but thank you so much for listening. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content, and follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and a lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.